Veal 10.
Yes, when he was in charge of the group that buried the dead in Dresden after the bombing, he came back with a pair of lace-up shoes. They were more like boots. And they stunk, and at night, when he took them off, he put not far away from where I slept, and I was sickened by that smell and asked him if he could put them closer to him. So he said, "Don't tell me what to do." I was rather afraid of him and Schweitzer because I didn't want to cross them in any way, but I felt that they were for themselves. Now, coming back to Dresden, when I was doing the work, both working in the factory and acting as a Laufers, the runner between the German section, one of the German girls there, she was perhaps early 20s, said to me, "Where do you come from?" So I said, "From a place called Hodage, in German is Godetz." So she said, "Do you know anybody there?" So I said, "Yes, the man who worked for us for 14 years, and he was very well treated, my father. I'm sure he's there." So she said, "Why don't you write him a letter to send you a parcel?" So I said, "Oh, yes, I will." So I wrote to him, and she posted it, and a parcel arrived. And there came a loaf of bread, so black home baked bread, a chunk of butter, and a piece of speck. Speck is really the fat of a roasted fat of pork, the fat part. Peasants, both in Poland, Hungary, other places, used to eat that placed on bread. In Hungary, they put a piece of paprika. In Poland, they just had that, or they fried it and put it inside a soup. So she took the butter and she took the speck and gave me the bread. At least I had the bread. And so it was also news that he was friendly enough, well-disposed to send this. But when we were sent to Lodz Ghetto, my father contemplated of handing me out to some family. He felt, no, it's too great a risk. I wouldn't survive because it means endangering their lives and our lives, because the punishment then, at the very beginning, helping Jew was enormous. So I had visions now, when I was alone, that when I come to Hodage, I'll come and see him. And I remember him as a child, because when I had holidays and my father used to send timber to be sawn up to the next town, I used to put very early on the car together with him. And he would stop halfway to this destination where the sawmill was, which cut these huge logs. We couldn't cope with that at home because my father didn't have an advanced sawmill of that size. And this place where we stopped halfway was making sausages, and he would dash in and buy himself sausage, and he would also share it with me or buy me some, although it was what's called treifer, non-kosher. I ate it because I liked it so much, and I would not share my news with anybody at home because I thought this would be terrible punishment. And I also hoped that God would forgive me for eating non-kosher food. Anyway, coming back to living with the Fuchses, just before I left, I said to the Fuchses and everybody who was assembled there, "I have something to tell you. My name is not Roman Podlaski, but Roman Holter, and I am a Jew." And they all burst out laughing. And Mr. Fuchs said, "I have news for you too. I am a German, but I am not a Nazi." And they seemed to have known from Mr. Hans Braun, but I didn't know this, that he must have rung them up to say that I'm coming and he's sending other people there. So it was slightly prearranged, but not to my knowledge. That sauerkraut and potato night before I left the following day, Schweitzer started telling of what he saw and experienced when he was in Auschwitz for such a long time. And although I saw certain brutalities when we arrived for that time, this was absolutely new to me, because he was there almost from the inception. And the the thing he told about Sonderkommando, or about being people being tattooed on their forehead and then being shot after such a time. It was so terribly penetrating. I never imagined that this would be done for such a long time to such a great number of people, although I saw the brutalities of my friends. And nothing came so much surprise. Yes, this sort of stirred me. My imagination never went as far as that. For enormous transport coming, and how father and mother would be taken away, and the grandmother would lead the children to gas chambers. And all. I don't think Mrs. Fuchs touched very much of the sauerkraut and potatoes, or Mr. Fuchs, but it felt that Schweitzer grew up with that, or certain parts of him grew up with it, so he saw it quite in a different light. So that when it came for my leaving the following day, I wished them well, but I was really liberated in parting from them and going on.
The other thing is, are there any more details you could give me of the death march? You know, you have explained
yes.
those awful incidents, you know, particularly the one in the Market Square.
Yes. Well, the death march started in a very strange way straight away, that people who were lingering too much were taken and led back slightly. And then when he heard shots and they never returned, the SS came back. So I knew that those who cannot keep up will suffer this death. Mr. Nussbaum, who came with us to load up the machines, and he was such a cultured man, and he was the one who played Mozart on the comb and could hum various classical tunes and new languages. He was like a designer draftsman, and he used to say to me, if you want, because I used to bring the drawings from the office for him to interpret, to make detailed drawings for the machines, for the tool makers, if you survive and you have to become someone, well, always search for a profession, because it enfranchises your mind. He said, even with a lot of money, you can only eat 3 meals a day and sleep in one bed. And his words meant quite a lot to me, because I never had that sort of thing, and it was very nice to speak to him. He was struck with dysentery, and he had a very hard time walking, and his wife, who was also a very lovely cultured woman, small one, kept on begging that he should be helped. And Himovich, who had great feeling for Nussbaum, said, if anybody is strong enough, please put a blanket between you two and help him out, give him a helping hand, because he can't keep up. If he drags behind, he's going to be taken a shot. So he asked two people from Auschwitz, who were in our group now, there were more than two, but these were the strongest guys, and they helped out. When an assessment came up and said, if you lose strength, you'll be dragged. When we cross the bridge, just drop him over. And when we were crossing the bridge at one point, this assessment came and said, now. And they threw him over the bridge down below. The wife screamed, and we went on. Those strugglers on the march, some of them who went out of line were hit by the SS, and the SS were very irritated, because they felt that they had to reach the destination certain time. They wanted to drive us on faster. And so more and more people who dragged on for the 2 days that we marched were taken back. And it was a quick process where the hole was dug and they were shot. Some of the people were taken to dig the holes and came back with their SS, and they didn't talk very much about it. Yes. To us, it became clearer that our end could also be the same, that eventually we are going to be taken somewhere and be shot. This is what was said by those who joined our group from Auschwitz, and they believed it firmly. And I believe them, that now our usefulness has come to an end. The march was brutal in another way, that it was very hard to procure extra food. We were given the bread, and some people had too much. And no new rations were given. Then when they brought certain soups, which was sort of porridge with a few potatoes in, those who were lucky enough to get it got it, others didn't get it. So it became very haphazard, and there was no distribution of food. Thus it was very hard to resist when in certain towns were presented as dreadful Jews, and food was thrown to us, not to really grab a piece of bread which was thrown and eat it. It took more than willpower, because sometimes people, despite the willpower, would make a movement towards a piece of bread, because it was an instinctive thing to get hold of it and eat it. So it seemed that the march was a sort of beginning to an end, that it's going to weaken us and eventually we'll be taken somewhere and finished off. There was nowhere to run away. There was absolutely nowhere. It was a terrain totally unknown to us. We thought that if our lot was very hard before, being in Germany amongst German people and being dressed the way we were in outfit, who is going to have sort of empathy, or who is going to give us assistance, who is going to take us in and shelter us? It seemed quite impossible. Feeling that hope evaporated there and then, that there was no light on the horizon. Therefore, to run away and sheltering somewhere and perhaps somehow living another day, another day, another day, was the only thing. And I had no hesitation. So now I'm coming back. When I said goodbye to Fuchses, and I told the Fuchses then that I'm a Jew, and they laughed. And I mentioned also that when I was embraced by my two colleagues, I felt that I should leave, that I did not find the warmth and the shelter in them that I would have wanted to see. And when it came to the crunch, I thought I would be ditched. And when it came whether they should survive or I, it would be them. So I got on the bike, and I was told that I have to make my direction towards Bautzen and Görlitz. And I set off, and I cycled. And when I came closer towards Bautzen, I had one puncture, because there were holes in the road, and I had another puncture. And then I was left on the rims of the bicycle. It was rather warm, and I took everything off, and the sun was warming me. I came to, before Bautzen, I came to a place where I sheltered in an outhouse of a deserted farm, but wasn't deserted, because when I came to wash myself by the well, an old lady came out, and she took some water from the well, and I went back, and we had an exchange, and I said, I'm a Jew, a Jude. So she looked at me with sort of angry eyes, and she went in and locked the door, and I went back, and I was afraid, really. I took my bicycle in, which had already rims on, that something might happen at night, but nothing happened. And very early in the morning, I set off. I again had water from the well. And when I came closer towards Bautzen, and there were these potholes, and Russian lorries used to go by, and when there was a pothole in the road, they used to go on the field and carry on. I would wave and ask them to give me a lift, but nobody stopped. You know, I was totally ignored in that. Then I came to an area where dead people were lying, and the German people in uniform were youth. There must have been some sort of battle, but mostly there were very young people, young German, and sometimes the Russian was lying too. And then I saw horses, dead horses, and there was a farmhouse which was in the distance, so with a partly roof shot off. So I made my way towards it. It was totally deserted. And I decided that I'm going to shelter there overnight, up in that loft. When I came in, part of the roof was shot up, but there was like a mattress lying there, straw mattress. So I pulled my bicycle up and put that ladder up, this sort of very simple, home-constructed ladder, that nobody should come up there. And I put my Tyrol jacket over my head and fell asleep. I bound a piece of string to the bicycle so nobody could steal it at night. But before I went to sleep, I sort of looked around and things were rather dusk and hazy. In the morning, when I woke up very early, I found I was in the middle of a sort of cemetery where the dead were not buried. It was quite ghastly. It was a field full of corpses still. And suddenly it occurred to me that if I'm caught there, I'll be shot straight away. People will think that I'm plundering or so on. So realization came over me. And I lowered the ladder, came down, lowered my bicycle. And I searched for food, because the sandwiches which Mrs. Fuchs gave me were nearly finished. I kept sort of a bite or two still back. I supplemented, because at that time already young rhubarb was growing on the side. And I ate it raw, and I liked the sourness of the rhubarb. My body seemed to have needed it. So I peeled the rhubarb and ate the inner part, and I picked some more and put it on a bicycle on the back. There was a little wire cage. And then I searched in the farm. Everything was dead. The horses were dead. And as I came out underneath the canopy, I heard a hollow sound, so I went over it a number of times. And then I found an implement, started digging, and buried, not deep down, was a kitchen cupboard. And I opened the doors and was full of glass preserves of meat. So out of my Tyrol jacket, I made a pouch and put straw in and put some of the jars. And I opened one. It was delicious. It was like preserved meat inside. And I thought to myself, oh, even if I have to make my way anywhere towards Siberia, I'll make it now with all this food. So I went across the field. I checked along the compass the way Mr. Fuchs showed me, and I was heading direction, the right direction. Then I came to the road. It said Bautzen, towards Bautzen that way. And I went on further, and there was another road that met up. Then I heard a motorbike. And this motorbike came closer, and there was a Russian. And the Russian stopped. And I thought, oh, German were the enemies. This is a lovely Russian. So my father, who spoke Russian, served in the Tsar army, always sort of mentioned a few words in Russian. I knew that Здравствуйте is hello in Russian, so I said Здравствуйте. And he said quickly something, and then he said, Давай, часы, give me a watch. So I said, no, I haven't. So he asked me, showed me to pull up my arms out. I had nothing. So he said, what is there? Sort of pointing to the pouch. So I took out one jar and I went, Спасибо, you know, please. You know. So he looked at it and he looked at me and lifted up and smashed it onto the ground. And I thought, oh, what a waste. My one of the lovely jars with meat. And then he asked me to lower my trousers, whether I have something around my waist. And I did that. And I stood there with my trousers down, my private parts showing. And I said in Polish, you know, I'm Jew. And then in Russian, I'm Ivrei, a Jew. I was in camp and so on. And he said, Ivrei. And as I stood there, this clumsy part, he took out his pistol. put it to my head, went, nothing happened, just a click of the, and he put it back in the holster and kicked his motorbike and drove off. And I looked at this all shattered meat on the ground, and I thought, shall I pick up the big pieces? But I thought, no, I mustn't. Certain dignity, one mustn't live like a dog. And I went on, and I was rather sick from the meat which I had when I started off, because the fat was too much for me. I wasn't used to it. So I vomited and had some more rhubarb, and that sort of helped me, and then had some more water. And I thought then that I must, if I have it, I must have just a little bit with some rhubarb, not too much of it, because it I could not digest it. It was much too much for me. And then I came to Bautzen when I found that, made my way towards the railway line, and I saw people being cordoned off there. So I wanted to get inside the cordon, and I was pushed away. And where's the cordon going? They said, it's going east. So I said, oh, I'm going east too. Please, could I come in? No, no. So eventually an officer came up, and he noticed that I was trying to get in, so he got hold of me by the neck like one picks up a kitten. And together with the bicycle, he was so big, strong, enormous. And he said in Russian, who are you? Where are you going? So I said, I don't know Russian, but can I tell you in Polish? So he said, yes. He spoke Polish too. And I noticed that his uniform differed slightly from the other ones. And I said, told him that I'm a Jew. I was in concentration camp, and I was in dress and working, and I make my way to Poland. So he said, you wait there and don't move. And if you try to get in, I'll personally shoot you. Do you understand? In Polish. And just wait there. And so I waited, and these people who were loaded up were all Russians who worked in Germany, whether they were Cossacks or other ones, and they were rounded up. And then he came up and gave me a loaf of bread, and he said, come with me. And I followed him, and he stopped the lorry and said something to them, and they were going towards Görlitz, and he put me on the lorry, and I insisted on holding the bike at the very end. And I thought, oh, I could have been on the train. Why did he not put me on the train? Well, I don't know where these people were going. They were going somewhere to the depths of Russia. And then in Görlitz, he asked the driver to take me to a point, and he took me to a point there at the station. And he said something else to another Russian. And this Russian took me on along the platform. And there were open trains, like coal-carrying trains. And this one had this sort of ladder. And when we climbed up to the top, when he climbed up and he said something, and they had to move a corner for me, when I looked down, it was just like a nest. People made themselves at home. They were all sitting there, and there were various Polish families who were going back to Poland. And grudgingly, they made a little corner for me, and I slid down there. But the bicycle was taken away, my one non possession then. And but I kept the meat with me and the loaf of bread which he gave me, which I already consumed a little bit of it. And the two people, so I could call them boy and girl, but they were in their 20s, said, have you got water? So I said, no. So I said, well, just leave everything here, we're going to guard it. Go and get water, because on the journey we need water. Get a container in which to pee, because that's very important. And so I was very grateful to them, and they really guarded my thing. And I climbed over and got this. And this is the way I eventually arrived to Chodecz. But I had to change train and came to my town. When I came to my town, really, I found that three families lived in my parents' house, and they rather angrily and grudgingly met me on the doorstep. I thought I would be welcomed by everyone. So I went to Podlavsky, who worked for us for 14 years, and he took me in. And he said, I must tell you that your parents left the fur and various things which I have in my loft, and this is yours. So I said, no, please, you must keep this. This, you have it. And Mrs. Podlaska, who was a pragmatist, said, well, in which case we'll sell some of it and buy a pig. And they said, but you are quite welcome to stay with us. And I found that really the people who lived in the house felt that if they don't finish me off, they will have to give part of the house back, and it was easier to do away with me. And when I was there, three girls, Pinchevsky, who were also on Lodz Ghetto, came back, and they were hiding in the attic of their house. The people who lived there gave them the attic. When I came to see them, they said that two of their closest relations went to Russia, and they think that they may come back, and then they will all go together. Would I like to stay with them? I said, no, not really. I feel that I'm not going to survive long here. I better make my way to Lodz or some. And then I heard that Eva, my eldest brother's wife, survived. I'll skip little things there because they're insignificant details, really.
I wonder what it was like, though, going back to your home. You know, you'd left it, although so much had happened.
Well, each day was worse than the other because I went to the cemetery. That was all ploughed up. The pavements where the paving stones from the Jewish cemetery turned upside down. When you lifted one, you had a Hebrew there. The synagogue was burned. The houses were occupied now, where Jewish people lived, by other people. It felt strange. The only thing which was the same was the lake. The people who were together with me in school showed a certain interest, but not a great warmth. One day, I went to the lake, and I saw a very old wooden lady collecting kindling. And when I came closer, that was Mrs. Eschner. Mrs. Eschner lived next door to us. She was German, and she had these sons who were like Oaks and her husband. They were machine tool makers, tractor repairers. And she was the one that once they had plum trees growing adjoining our fence. When I was lying, recovering from appendicitis, and I felt I was strong enough, I conceived that I would climb the fence and pick some of the plums. And when it was so very quiet in the bedrooms, but my parents were in the sitting room still, I lowered myself. It was not very deep down from my bedroom down to the ground. And climbed the fence, tucked my pyjama top into my trousers, and was pulling down the plums and putting it under my pyjama. When suddenly a hand got hold of me, and that was Mrs. Eschner, and I nearly jumped out of my skin. And she said, Romek, which is a diminutive of Roman, you are stealing. I said, I'm sorry, Mrs. Eschner. So she said, no, you have to be punished. So I said, well, please don't tell my mother or my father because I'm not allowed to do this. I said, so you know it's wrong. You are stealing. Well, tomorrow after school, you must come up to me and I'll give you the punishment. So I came to her and she made me peel a whole bowl of potatoes. I had to be there till I finished peeling. And that was my punishment. So here I saw Mrs. Eschner. And when the Germans came, her son was trained as SS and took together with her other sons. And Carl was only 2 or 3 years older, and we sometimes walked to school together. And he became an SS man. He was the one who punched me when I was carrying the bale of pig's wool from the dairy. And I helped her with the kindling, and she said that none of them have come back, none of her sons, that her husband's also dead, that she's all alone. She didn't want to ask me about my parents, but we sort of limped along, trying to talk about our tragedies, but not managing quite to do so. Now, when I came back, she was living in this one little cell. Most of the house was taken away now by Polish people, but she had nowhere to go. And she waited also, like I waited, whether her sons or her husband or whatever happened were going to come back. And I, although I knew that people, my family were taken away, I hoped that my brother, who was taken to Russia, would come back, that Sister Zosia, who was in Warsaw, may come back, that Petra, who was the manager in the factory, in Lodz, the textile, that just before we were sent to Lodz Ghetto, he disappeared from Lodz Ghetto with his wife and child, that he would come back. But it was a ghost town, and I decided that I'm going to go to Lodz. And so I left for Lodz.